This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice arrived in South Korea on the second leg of an Asian tour to push for cooperation in enforcing United Nations sanctions, Chinese President Hu Jintao dispatched a high-level envoy to Pyongyang for talks with North Korean leader Kim Jong-il. This comes amid speculation that there may be a second nuclear test soon. The deputy head of North Korea's foreign ministry, Lee Gun, said a second test would be natural and that the United States should not be surprised if one were carried out. North Korea, in its public statements, usually does not mince words. Statements describe the sanctions unanimously approved by the Security Council over the weekend as a declaration of war and as gangster-like. When the United States criticized North Korea's human rights record, Pyongyang shot back, "It cannot but be a tragedy in the 21st century that the United States, which is the world's wasteland of human rights and an empire of evil, to dare to discuss human rights." Amid the bluster and the threats, is there any way to figure out what they're trying to say, who they're speaking to, and what they want? Later in the program, why Israel bans Palestinian students from advanced studies at Israeli universities and why one Palestinian wants to go. But first, reading North Korea. If you have questions about what North Korea says, what it means, or what it's like today in North Korea, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. And we begin with Selig Harrison, director of the Asia Program at the Center for International Policy and senior scholar of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. And nice to have you here with us in Studio 3A.
Nice to be here.
You've been to North Korea 10 times, as I understand it. You were, I think, the first American admitted to the country after the Korean War. As you listen to comments like the ones issued this week, the repeated comments going back 10 years or more to, you know, if war breaks out, Seoul will turn into a sea of fire. Do they mean such things?
No, I think that's the kind of rhetoric you get from a regime that feels embattled. And when you go to North Korea, that's what you're aware of. It's hard sitting in Washington to get the view from Pyongyang, which is of a country that thinks it might have to go through what Iraq's been going through.
Mm-hmm.
And the regime, the leaders were the people I met mostly when I was there, but you get that also from people who are not leaders and who have been given a big dose of not only propaganda, but also a lot of very credible, you know, arguments. The leaders say to them, look, the Americans have been willing to lose 20,000 wounded in Iraq, 4,000 dead. They take this regime change business seriously. So the perception in North Korea, universal, regime and the people, is that they are threatened, first by U.S. Financial pressures, which have been going on long before the sanctions adopted by the U.N. just now.
Mm-hmm.
For the past year, the U.S. Treasury has been imposing financial sanctions on North Korea, trying to get all the banks in the world not to deal with them, which, of course, the regime sees as putting a noose around their neck, trying to block all access to international trade and investment and close up their bank accounts. And
the United States does that because North Korea counterfeits American money.
Well, that's the Bush administration's rationale. There is one case where they say that they have some evidence of counterfeiting that they haven't put forward yet. But that's a relatively small matter, a bank in Macau that we hear a lot about. What we don't hear so much about is the Treasury Department's imposition of a global effort to get banks everywhere to have nothing to do with North Korea, regardless of what kind of transaction it is. And that's where the North Koreans
mm-hmm.
feel very aggrieved and where they feel that they're part of a squeeze designed to bring down their regime, and why that makes the regime change fears very real. It's not just a fear of military action. It's a belief that we are systematically trying to squeeze them financially and bring them down even without military action.
Yet these kinds of statements that they routinely issue, presumably these are for foreign consumption. These are for issued statements to be broadcast in the media around the world, in South Korea, in Japan, in China.
Yeah, they certainly,
not just the United States.
They could certainly use a good PR advisor. They have, they're always coming forth with bombastic rhetoric. And I think that you have to go back into the whole psychology of this small country. Korea as a whole has always felt victimized by great powers around it. And the Korean War isn't over yet legally. We're still there. We still have forces there. There's just an atmosphere of a sort of what I call a permanent siege mentality, which leads them into this bombastic, very self-defeating way of relating to the rest of the world. I spent a lot of time when I was there, when I was talking to the leaders. I met six high-ranking North Koreans, and I said, look, don't go ahead with this nuclear test. You say that you want to negotiate with the United States, you want to return to bilateral negotiations, and that was what I got most of the time I was there. I said to them, look, if you have a nuclear test or a series of nuclear tests, it's just going to make it harder. You're going to have much less chance of getting into dialogue with the United States. What they say is, look, we take the regime change approach of the Bush administration seriously.
Mm-hmm.
We look at 20,000 wounded, 4,000 dead in Iraq, and we think you're serious about regime change, and we don't want to have happen to us what happened to Iraq, so we want to show you that we're tough. They're trying to prove their manhood all the time, and the more you put on the pressure against North Korea, we've learned for the last, really, 30 or 40 years, every time we've tried to put on the pressure, we've just gotten bad results.
Yet South Korea, which has had the sunshine policy of trying to develop North Korea's economy, help it in any number of ways, and then the DPRK says things like they will demolish South Korea's state-run Korean broadcasting system and kill everyone involved.
Well, I don't know where that quote has come from, but lately, since the sunshine policy was started in the year 2000, there hasn't been any incident at the DMZ, and many people in South Korea consider it a great success from the standpoint of easing military tensions along the DMZ.
Mm-hmm.
And then South Korea is essentially concerned with avoiding what happened in Germany. They don't want to have to pay the bill for a very costly collapse of North Korea. So they're opposed, as is China, to pressures on North Korea.
And North Korea is vastly more impoverished than East Germany was.
It is impoverished, but you got to draw a distinction. And this is one of the things I found there that I was most struck by. Pyongyang is a city-state. It's a capital where the elite and are living not too badly. You go there and you don't see this famine that we read about in North Korea. That's out in the countryside, in certain districts of the countryside. What you see in Pyongyang now are more cars than I've ever seen before, more bicycles, more mom-and-pop stores. And the most amazing thing that has changed since I first started going there in 1972, as a result of the economic reforms that they've been pursuing internally for the last 5 years or so, people want to make money. Everybody's trying to figure out how to make a buck and how to hustle some kind of a financial advantage for himself or herself or family. And, you know, when you went there in 1972 and you went to a factory or a collective farm and you said, tried to see what kind of incentives they were giving the hardworking people to get to more of a profit than the others, you were told, well, we don't work we work for the glory of the great leader.
Hmm.
Now you've got an atmosphere which has changed in the last 5 years. It's okay, it's respectable to want to make money. And so people are looking for enterprises to start, kiosks, mom and pop stores. The state enterprises in North Korea used to be the typical communist style of economy. If a factory lost money, the central government made up the loss. And if they made money, they didn't really gain from it, the people who were running the factory. Now they're encouraged to keep, if they make money, they keep more of it. If they lose money, they do not get subsidized. And although the state continues to own enterprises, everything is really leased. It's kind of a halfway house to privatization, and people can profit from their hard work.
Yet North Korea remains dependent on food aid to feed its people. For more on that, joining us now is Mike Huggins. He's a spokesman for the World Food Program, just got back from a 5-day trip to North Korea. He's with us on the phone from Beijing in China. Thanks very much for staying up so late to speak with us. We know it's very early in the morning there.
You're very welcome.
What's the food situation like right now in North Korea?
Well, it's better than it has been in many years, but it's still, many people remain extremely, they still have a very precarious existence. You know, this year's harvest is not as good as what it has been in the last 2 years. There is, I think, still many people in the country who are just not able to make their own food aid to meet their own food needs. I think that what we risk now is losing many of the gains that we have made over the last 10 years since the country experienced the widespread famine.
Yesterday, we heard a report here in this country on NPR's Morning Edition by reporter Michael Sullivan, who spoke with a defector now living in South Korea, who said, "The first thing you think about when you wake up is food. Where can you get food? And if you can't find any, you spend the night hungry, knowing there's no guarantee the next day will be any better." Do you think that's an accurate reflection of at least some people's experience in North Korea?
I think that probably is a very good reflection of many people's experience there. I mean, I have to premise everything with the fact that we only have access to 50 counties in the country out of about 203. So, you know, we're in very small areas right now. We have had greater access in the past, but, you know, since last December, the government asked us to reduce our presence in the country. A year ago, the World Food Program was feeding about 6 million people in North Korea. Today, we should be feeding about 2 million right now, but we only have the resources to feed about a million. So we're facing a very grim prospect over the coming months of not even being able to feed the million that we're currently feeding now.
And obviously, winter time is approaching quickly.
Absolutely, and winter as well as the lean season, it's a double whammy for many people in North Korea. And you've got to remember that many people do lack, basic multivitamins and minerals and fatty acids in their diet, and that's why so many people rely on food aid. So we're only sort of helping, you know, the tip of the iceberg. We realize that. We do urge the international community to step up to the plate as well and ensure that we have the resources we need to feed the minimum that we're getting.
Mike Huggins, stay with us. Also, Selig Harrison. We'll have more after a break and your calls. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. For years, North Korea hurled threats at its neighbors and at the United States. After the UN approved sanctions last week, Pyongyang promised unspecified physical countermeasures against the U.S. Today we're trying to make sense of this rhetoric. Is it calculated maneuvering or verbal tantrum? Our guests are Selig Harrison, director of the Asia Program at the Center for International Policy, and Mike Huggins, who's just back from 5 days in North Korea with the World Food Program. Of course, you're welcome to join the conversation. If you have questions about what North Korea says, what it means, or what it's like today in North Korea, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. And let's get Laura on the line. Laura's calling us from Des Moines.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to, so your second guest kind of touched on what my question was what is being done internationally for the average citizen there? I know they are impoverished and food is a real issue. And from what I can remember, I think there's only two countries that are still continuing to give direct aid that way. And I want to kind of touch on that a little more.
Mm-hmm. Mike Huggins, can you help us out? Who's providing that food aid distributed by the World Food Program?
Well, I mean, we have donors, many donors. We have Australia, South Korea. We have Russia has just given 12,000 tons of grain to the World Food Program for distribution in North Korea. The phone call your guest there is meaning is bilateral aid.
Uh-huh.
And most of the bilateral aid is coming from South Korea and to a much lesser extent China.
And the food aid, you were saying that you're only feeding a fraction of those who probably need it. Is access to feeding those people restricted because of lack of food, or is it restricted by the North Korean government?
We have a policy of no access, no food, and you know, we try to enforce as much as we can the monitoring side of the process. We are facing mainly challenges from not having enough resources. For example, we should be in 50 counties in the country right now, but we're only able to work in 30 because we don't have the money to expand our operation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think very soon the North Korean government is going to realize that because of the drop-off in bilateral aid, they are going to need an increase in WFP's presence in the country. But we're not going to be able to do that if we don't get the money in.
Hmm. Laura, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Mike, before we let you go, you've been to North Korea several times over the years. Have you noticed any changes over the course of your visit?
I have, and I also noted C-League's observations there, and I have to agree with him. I mean, I've only been going there since 2001, but most certainly in the last week that I was there, I did notice many more cars on the street, many more people sort of mingling around, and also a much lighter atmosphere to what I have noticed before. I think people in general, at least in the capital, look healthier than what they did when I first went there 5 years ago. When I first went there 5 years ago. But and I also think that there's an element of ease among many people. They do just seem more relaxed. They seem to be less regimented. I saw kids in primary schools being much more relaxed and much more sort of spontaneous in the way that they behaved. And I took that to be a very promising sign.
And there's much less of a personality cult than there used to be. I mean, when Kim Il-sung was the leader, you had loudspeakers booming out over everywhere you went. With Kim Jong-il, there's still a lot of that stuff, but it's much softer.
Would you agree, Mike?
Yes, I would. I was never there when Kim Il-sung was alive, but I definitely think that there's a massive change.
Mike Huggins, thanks very much, and we're going to let you get back to bed.
Thank you very much.
Mike Huggins, a spokesman for the World Food Program, just returned from 5 days in North Korea with us on the phone from Beijing in China. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is John. John's with us from Boston.
Hi, thank you for taking me.
Sure.
I was watching one of the cable news channels last week, and a North Korean woman who actually escaped to China was interviewed, and she lived in a village, and I was surprised by two things. A, she said that she had a VCR, and B, she said she watched smuggled South Korean soap operas on that VCR, and she said she and a lot of her fellow villagers took pleasure in watching that. So my question is, how much exposure and knowledge does the average North Korean citizen have of the outside world?
Celia Harrison?
Well, it's still a very tight ship. It is a police state, and they do everything they can to keep out the kinds of outside influences that they think might lead to political trouble. But you can't keep it all out, and across that Chinese border with refugee flows, and with cell phones and with VCRs, and, it's...
Do people in North Korea have cell phones and VCRs?
No, people in North Korea don't necessarily have them, but they... some people are allowed to have them, actually. Foreigners in North Korea are now allowed to have them. There was a period when the number of people in the North Korean elite were allowed to have them. That was then clamped down upon. But what I meant was that you can make connections, because there are the cell phones out in China, it's getting increasingly hard for them to keep out an awareness of what's going on in the outside world. But what's fascinating is that the system inside the country, with the blessing of the leadership, has loosened up, and people, it's like when Deng Xiaoping in China said it's glorious to get rich. Well, in North Korea, it's no longer inglorious to get rich, although nobody's actually put it the way Deng Xiaoping did. And it's this change in the attitude toward making money, the fact that people are hustling for ways to take care of themselves in what, as Mike said, is an atmosphere of considerable privation, that I find the most remarkable change. And this, so we have a very anomalous situation. On the one hand, we see North Korea moving toward economic reforms, which we want them to do. At the same time, we see them battening down the hatches on the nuclear front and all this tension developing, which is leading to responses on our part that are stopping the flow of external influences into the country. These financial sanctions that I mentioned earlier keep a factory that has a joint venture with a company in Sweden or Germany making widgets from importing the stuff you need to make widgets. And so that we say we're trying to open up North Korea to the outside world, but as one of the tragic consequences of this growth of attention, we're actively trying to bottle them up.
To try to help us understand the ethnic and national identity of North Korea, let's talk now with Jiuk Shin. He's director of the Shorenstein Asia-Pacific Research Center at Stanford University and also the co-editor of the Journal of Korean Studies and author of many books, including Ethnic Nationalism in Korea, Genealogy, Politics, and Legacy. He's currently writing a book on U.S.-Korean relations. He's with us today from the studio on Stanford University's campus in Palo Alto, California. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you.
How important is national identity in North Korea, and how is it distinct from South Korean identity?
Well, first of all, we have to understand their history. I think going back to late 19th century, Mr. Harrison already talked about threat perception, and I think that's real not only for North Korean but also South Korean people. If you look at Korean modern history, we have to remember that there were three major wars on the Korean Peninsula. In 1894 and 5, Sino-Japanese War, and 10 years later, war between Russia and Japan, and then Korean War in 1950. Mm-hmm. In all three major wars, powers, Japan, China, Russia, U.S., they were involved. Okay, therefore, the threat perception is a real thing for North Korean people, and that's something we really have to understand.
I see. So in that sense, that's not distinct, you would think, between North and South. Is there any special North Korean identity?
Well, first of all, I think there are two different identities. Okay, one identity that both North and South Korea share is ethnic identity. Okay, both North and South Korean people, they share the belief that they belong to the same race, mm-hmm. same Korean nation, same bloodline. So in that sense, they are same. They are not different from each other. But at the same time, after 1945, with territorial division, they were contending who will be representing the Korean national community. Is it going to be North or South? So in that sense, in terms of political identity, they are different, and also they were contending to represent the whole ethnic Korean national community.
Hmm. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Kenneth. Kenneth with us from South Carolina.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
My question is, with North Korea setting off all the weapons, what is the education level like, and do the citizens know exactly what's going on when you set off those type of weapons?
Mm-hmm. They've only set off one, at least so far, Kenneth. But anyway, let's see if we can get a response from Jiuk Shin.
Well, first of all, I think their literacy rate is very high. They are highly educated. But at the same time, I still believe that ordinary people are, quite isolated from the outside world. I believe that the elite, they know what's going on outside. But when you talk to, common people, I still believe that they have very limited information about outside world.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of their response to the nuclear weapons, Celia Harrison, have you?
Well, I think that they're very proud that they appear to have been able to achieve this technical feat of exploding a nuclear weapon, although we don't really know yet. The government, Kim Jong-il and his, they present this as a great achievement of the Korean people, something to be proud of. And they, unfortunately, they have a lot of, they can make a plausible case to the people that the country is threatened. And that, against the background that we've just heard discussed historically, is quite powerful. The fact is that the present administration has, in Washington, has had a division between people who want to negotiate seriously a denuclearization deal with North Korea in exchange for the normalization of relations between North Korea and the United States, which the North Koreans want, and people in the administration, starting with the president, who've said quite clearly he said he would like to topple the Kim Jong-il regime. He loathed Kim Jong-il. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the government is able to use that. He once called Kim Jong-il a pygmy. And, you know, the government is able to use that to present the picture to the people that the country is threatened and only the great leadership is saving them from another Korean War, from another Japanese invasion like the kind that led to colonialism. And so I think the answer to your caller is that the dangers and the risks and the recklessness that was demonstrated in the nuclear test is not seen that way by the people, and the government can say to them, look, the Americans won't even ratify the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, and yet they're telling us we can't have a nuclear test. We've had one nuclear test, and they've had 1,000, and they have 10,000 nuclear weapons. So tell that to the North Korean people, and they don't see it the way we do.
We're talking about North Korea, and by the way, Kenneth, thanks very much for the call. And we're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Here's an email question we got from Paul in Columbus, Ohio. Having visited and toured the DMZ and stepped on North Korean soil, things there are obviously tense. For example, you were not permitted to look the North Korean guards in the eyes while on the North Korean side of the DMZ. My question is, are civilians of either North or South Korea allowed to cross the border even to visit family? Jiukshin?
Well, yeah, they are, but very limited. You have to get a permission from the government of both North and South. So it's not like, you know, you can just cross the line to visit your family member in the North. You have to get permission once again, and then, you know, the numbers are very limited. But on the other hand, you can visit like Mount Geumgang area as a tourist. And I think a lot of people, you know, visiting, you know, Kaesong, industrial complex in the area and so on. So I think there are more traveling between two Koreas, but it's not like you can just visit your family member in the North.
Mm-hmm. Is there an element, Jiukshin, in North Korea's ideology of racial purity? We read an op-ed in the New York Times by an American professor who works in South Korea who argued that they see South Koreans as somehow corrupted. Is that an accurate perception?
I think yes and no, because, you know, still Korean people believe that they have a single bloodline, their bloodline is very pure. But that's also like, you know, more kind of, you know, rhetoric. It's more like a politically correct issue that you have to say that, you know, even though you may not believe. But as I mentioned, after 1945, both North and South Korea were contending. Yeah, who's more authentic?
Yes.
Yeah, who can better represent the Korean nation? So from North Korean perspective, South Koreans are corrupt because they are puppets of, you know, quote-unquote American imperialism, right?
Mm-hmm.
But from South Korean perspective, same thing. North Koreans were contaminated by communism. They are just, you know, catering, you know, Soviet interests and so on. So there has been rhetorical wars, you know, between the Koreas for a long time.
I think, go ahead,
Taylor.
I'm
just going to say I think there's been a big change. I mean, 10 or 15 years ago, North Korea still did have the attitude that South Korea had been had prostituted itself to too much Japanese economic influence, U.S. economic and military influence. But you've had quite a change, I think, in the last 10 years and particularly the last 5 years. They really want to normalize with the U.S. They want to open up. And it's very ironic that just during that period, when they've begun to recognize that they have to open up in order to progress and they want to join the world, things have closed up because of the tensions between the United States and North Korea.
Jiukshin, we just have a few seconds before we have to go to a break. Do you believe North Korea wants to open up, expose its people to broadcasts from around the world and culture from around the world?
No, I didn't say that.
Ah, that's what a lot of people think of as opening up.
Yeah, I doubt.
Right now, we're continuing our conversation about North Korea. Our guests are Selig Harrison, director of the Asia Program at the Center for International Policy, and Jiukshin, director of the Shorenstein Asia-Pacific Research Center at Stanford University. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Stefan. Is it Stephen or Stefan? I don't know how you pronounce it.
Stefan,
go ahead, please. Calling from Charlotte.
I can go ahead and ask a question?
Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay. My name is Stefan, and I'm calling you from Charlotte, North Carolina. I just have a quick question for you. I'm originally from Romania, and as you remember, Romania was a communist country before the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember it was very close with North Korea, with countries as Iraq. Mm-hmm. My question is, how much the communist ideology influenced North Korean behavior right now?
Jiuk Shin.
Well, in my view, the most influential ideology is nationalism, not so much communism. I think it's nationalism, and also, as I said, you know, ethnic nationalism, you know, with like Kim family as like the big father of like family nation. So in my view, North Korea is like, you know, family nation, and main ideology is nationalism.
Would you agree with that, Selig Harrison?
Yes, I think that's very well put. They've sort of taken over the Confucian tradition, which is very powerful in Korean society, and they've somehow managed to meld it with this repressive police state in North Korea. But the point is that the present regime is in an ambivalent position. You know, they are trying to open up in the sense that they want to open up in a controlled way, just as China did. They don't want to lose power, the regime that's there, but they know they need outside influences and money and technology and capital. So they're trying to find ways to open up gradually while keeping political control. That's going to be a neat trick, and it does lead to a lot of paradoxical situations.
Stefan, thanks very much.
No problem.
Let's go now to Dave. Dave's calling us from somewhere in Massachusetts. I can't read that, Dave.
Bernardston, hi.
Bernardston. Go ahead, please.
Thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I'm just curious as to whether or not it would make any difference in relations and discussions and those type of things if we actually ended the war with Korea. I mean, we've been in a ceasefire for, I don't know, 40 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
There's still a declared war, and I'm just wondering if that might help, you know, help with our position, help, you know, bring some discussions and those type of things if we said, well, I guess we'll stop warring with you guys now.
Well, Selig Harrison, negotiations on that point have been offered as part of a overall resolution of this nuclear issue.
Yeah, that's one of the keys to resolving the whole Korean issue. Ending the Korean War with a formal peace treaty, which until recently the Pentagon has been opposed to. Now we see some change in the administration's position. It would be a very important thing to do, but it has to go together with a broader movement to the normalization of relations. We not only are at a state of war with them, but we don't have diplomatic relations with them. And as Jim Baker said last week, it's not appeasement to sit down and talk to your enemies. And we've insisted in a rather rigid distinction between bilateral negotiations and the six-party negotiations in Beijing. The North Koreans are ready to resume the six-party negotiations, but they want bilateral negotiations first to resolve this very important issue that little understood of the financial banking sanctions that we've imposed during the last year, which they see as part of an effort to squeeze them and topple the regime. So, yes, the peace treaty is essential, and it's got to go together with a broader movement to normalize relations, which we have to tie to concessions at each step of the way that will lead to a rollback of their nuclear weapons program. It's still in its early stages. You know, it's not like India was at the time they tested, for example. India had already had bombs in the basement. North Korea is in the very early stages of its nuclear program. We can still roll it back if we go to a real diplomatic offensive to do so.
Thanks for the call, Dave.
Thank you.
And let's get one last one in. This is Gail. Gail calling us from Pennsylvania.
Hello. Yes, thank you. I heard something recently that I hope is not a silly question. I thought it was a silly comment, so I need to know the answer, that all the individuals in North Korea had speakers, some kind of speakers that could come through the radio or in their homes for the leaders to break in with propaganda whenever they wanted to.
Jiuk Shin, is that right?
Well, I've never been to North Korea, so maybe Mr. Harrison can better answer.
I think that's true. It's a police state.
Uh-huh.
We should be trying to open it up in every way to let the winds come in from the outside. Most apartment houses have loudspeaker systems. I don't know whether every apartment does, but I'm sure that the leadership does have that kind of system in all the apartment houses in North Korea.
So it's obviously very difficult to get to any of the people then.
On whose part, you mean?
Outsiders.
Yeah, outsiders. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, you can talk to people on the street when you go there. If you speak Korean, which I don't, you can do a much better job of doing that than I was able to do. But no, you just can't walk in off the street into neighborhoods the way you can do in an American city. When you go there, they try to have a minder with you all the time, but
right.
Basically it's changed enormously since I first started going there in 1972. All the foreign diplomats in Pyongyang, for example, can travel freely in automobiles, motorcycles, with licenses just the way you'd get in this country without anybody watching them. That was unthinkable 5 years ago. So the whole place is loosening up. But certainly it's still a police state, and they certainly know what's going on in all of the apartment houses. Most people are in apartment complexes, which I'm certain do have loudspeakers.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gail.
Okay.
And Celik Harrison, thanks very much for taking the time to be with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Celik Harrison, Director of the Asia Program at the Center for International Policy and Senior Scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Also, our thanks to Jiuk Shin, Director of the Shorenstein Asia-Pacific Research Center at Stanford University, with us today from the studio there in Palo Alto. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
When we come back, Israel and Palestinian students.